Welcome to the Eco News Report. I'm your host this week, Tom Wheeler, Executive Director of the Environmental Protection Information Center. The Eco News Report is brought to you by Humboldt Distillery. Not only do they sell delicious, organic, and locally available distilled spirits, for each bottle sold of their organic vodka, they will donate $1 to the California Coastkeeper Alliance. I think that's pretty cool. Pick up a bottle at your local grocer today. And I'm joined by my friend and co-host, Larry Glass, Executive Director of the North Coast Environmental Center. Hey, Larry.
Hey, Tom.
And we're also joined by legal fellow Matt Simmons from Epic. Hey, Matt.
Hey, Tom.
All right. And we have a very special show today. Three fun guests from Friends of the Shasta River. Dave Webb. Hey, Dave. Nice to see you.
Nice to be here with everybody.
Andrew Marks, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And Bill Chesney. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tom. Nice to be here as well.
All right. So if it wasn't clear already from our guests, we're going to be talking about the Shasta River, the pride and joy of the Friends of the Shasta River. And we're going to be talking about why it is this really special tributary to the Klamath River and why it's at risk. And this is going to be somewhat of a counterintuitive show because at times it's going to sound as if the government is doing the right thing, but we'll find out that this is a very clever cloaking device by the government to authorize behaviors that are going to further degrade and prevent the recovery of listed salmon in the Shasta River. So let's start off. Bill, I know that you are a longtime expert on the Shasta River and the salmon of the Shasta River. Can you tell us a little bit about this tributary? Because us folks on the coast, I don't think we know what's going on very far inland.
Sure. Yeah, the Shasta is a unique stream within the Klamath, at least from the Klamath below Iron Gate Dam, and that it's got a lot of spring runoff from snowmelt, but it also has a lot of spring inflow from the snowfall on Mount Shasta. It percolates, you know, and infiltrates the ground and charges these springs all around Mount Shasta. And then in the upper Shasta watershed, we've got these springs that are producing about summertime flows. Estimated flows are base flows are estimated about 350 to 400 cubic feet per second. And that's really unusual. Most of the streams around here are snowmelt hydrographs. So as the snow comes off, your flow drops. But this is actually the reverse is happening on the Shasta River because you've got all this groundwater being produced. And what that has allowed is you've got a habitat for over summer and salmonids. So, you know, historically it would have been like summer steelhead and spring chinook and coho, as well as lamprey. So these anadromous species are all doing very poorly because there's not a lot of habitat left like that in the Klamath. It's pretty well the first lowest hanging fruit for development. Everyone wants the spring on their property so they can impound it and draw water out of it. And that's what people have been doing here since European settlers first came in the 1850s. And that's had a real impact on these fish that require that over summer rearing habitat.
So prior to European settlement of the Shasta River Valley, I understand that it was perhaps the most important salmonid breeding ground for the Klamath River system, that something like 50% of returning salmon were going back to the Shasta. Is that right?
It's hard to say, but the production of Chinook is remarkable. You know, and Chinook typically are leaving the tributary system to go into the main stem and move out to the ocean in their first year of life, usually like in their first 3 or 4 months. But the other life histories of Chinook, the ones that stay in river for a year, as well as the other species like steelhead coho and lamprey, there's really nothing like it in the system that can provide that kind of over summer rearing habitat. So yeah, it's a unique and special river.
So Dave, I know that you were one of the founders of this Friends of the Shasta River group. Why was the group started?
Well, Bill and I have worked on the Shasta River for 25 to 30 years each. We stayed dedicated on the Shasta River because we could see the potential that it once had and still could have with just a modest amount of care and effort on the part of people using the water from it. And so after 30 years of trying the kid gloves, let's see what we can do on a voluntary basis approach, it had become more than obvious that we'd gone about as far as we could, and it wasn't nearly far enough. And then Bill ran into Andy out bicycling near Wairika and got to talking, and Andy was more of an active fisherman than us, and he too was fed up with the lack of substantive progress on fish protection, fish recovery in the Shasta. And he knew that it was an important tributary. And between the three of us, we just sort of had critical mass. We said, well, we've got to do something. Well, we still can't. And so we got together, gathered up some other people with an interest in salmon and the rivers coming off Mount Shasta, and here we are.
I think that yours is an important story in the larger story of the Klamath River. I know that there has been such an important focus, rightfully so, on getting out a lot of these fish passage blocking dams upriver, COPCO and whatnot. And that has been really the story of the Klamath that has been passed down to us here on the coast. That is almost the exclusive focus. I don't even know if folks here understand that the Shasta River exists. No offense. But it is certainly a fascinating river. It is different than the rest of the Klamath in other respects, too. It flows through kind of a desert environment, right?
It does. The Shasta Valley is in a rain shadow of both the Klamath Mountains and Mount Shasta. And so the storms come rolling in, these giant circular storms, and they'll be dumping rain and snow on the coast and flooding. And when they finally reach the Shasta Valley, if you're looking at the radar pictures, you can see that the storms just sort of shred and disappear and basically it leaves you with no rainfall at all in the Shasta Valley. So we range from 5 to 18 inches on the flatter portions of the valley floor of total rainfall in an area where normal crops want anywhere from 2 to 4 feet of water to grow. So agriculture really had to take the water from the river if they were going to be growing grass or alfalfa. But that desert environment and that flat valley floor brought with it some really unique features. The Shasta Valley is actually the largest volcanic lahar or debris flow in the world. So the whole valley floor is flattish and it's filled with a mud flow. It came down cold. It wasn't lava. It was a mud flow that filled in everything that was there and left it relatively flattish of this young volcanic sand and volcanic ash and bits and pieces of lava. And so water that rainfall and snow that lands on Mount Shasta percolates in and comes down through all of that recent volcanic stuff with lots of minerals in it, so particularly phosphorus. And as it comes down through that soil profile, it then encounters the underlying layer, which is an old marine layer called the Hornbrook Formation. And that Hornbrook Formation gives up some nitrogen to the water. And so the water is going underground, it's picking up phosphorus from the volcanics, it's picking up nitrogen from the old ocean sediments, and then it gets forced back up to the surface as the springs that Bill mentioned. And so it's traveled for miles and miles underground, yet it hasn't been touched. It hasn't been heated by the sun, it hasn't been contaminated by manure or runoff from fields. It comes up crystal clear. It's like floating on glass when you're out there in a boat. And that water is pre-fertilized with nitrogen and phosphorus, which then grows these outrageous aquatic plants that look very much like you're out in a tide pool in the ocean with all the leafy green materials and the colors and the surface areas. And those plants in turn then grow aquatic organisms that are the foundation of the food chain that feeds the salmon. And so you don't get a volcano in any other drainage here in the Shasta, in the Klamath Basin like that. You don't get those springs. You don't get that volcanic lahar. You don't get all of these serendipitous events that collectively left us with this low gradient stream where the fish don't have to work hard to stay in place, where the food comes to them, they don't have to hunt for it, and they can just grow bigger and faster than any place else on the face of the earth, and then out migrate and go downstream into the Klamath and into the ocean, and potentially be in much greater numbers than the river would ever suggest.
All right, so we have an extremely unique an interesting river system that historically has produced great salmon runs to the Klamath River system. And there is now some sort of an issue. And let's get into the issue of the Shasta. And I think that we've talked a little bit about it before, which is the development around the river, right? So what is this problem here? Why are salmon having an issue in the Shasta River?
Talk about flow, because I think that's where you're headed at.
All right. So we have this terribly interesting river system. We have historically great salmon runs, but we have a problem. Bill, what is that problem going on in the Shasta River?
There's no in-stream flow that's been established for fish. So when the adjudication was done, I think in 1932, correct me if I'm wrong, Dave, but they allocated the water for all the users at the time, with nothing set aside for the river. or Fish and Wildlife. And so basically they gave away all the water with nothing left over. So when the water master is doing their job, they don't, you know, they'll typically leave a little bit, but if it sags below, like we had a couple of years in the past, we had less than 4 cubic feet per second at the mouth of the river in June. And this is at the time, like we were saying, is when the unimpaired flow of the river is 350 cubic feet per second. So you've got a river where there hasn't been any set aside for the resource, fish and wildlife. And as a result, the problems that we're seeing with declining populations and fish being unable to oversummer, it's not a surprise at all. What David mentioned about talking about the springs and the unique characteristics of their chemistry and the nutrients, the temperature is one of the things that's really remarkable, is that you've got water starting in the upper watershed at 13 degrees. I mean, you look at a temperature plot of that water day in, day out, it's just a flat line. It just stays at 13 degrees. And so every day it begins with that temperature. It gets warmer as it heads downstream, of course, but it's a custom made to grow fish. I mean, you can't have a better setup like that. So when people impound that water because they want to pump out of it, that right away, that's going to warm it up because you're going to have a surface area that's going to be greatly increased and it's going to capture solar radiation. Your cold water now is quickly warmed, which pretty well takes away as for a habitat for the fish to utilize.
So you have both water flow issues, the total amount of water that's available in the river. There's not enough because people have too many straws in it, or they divert springs so that water that has historically gone to the river is not getting into the river now. And you're also seeing temperature issues. Are there any pollutant issues? It sounds like historically there was sufficient nutrients in the river to have rich biological life. But I also imagine that if you have agriculture near the river, you might also have some nutrient flow issues into the river.
In 2017, we took bacterial samples in the Shasta River at 6 different locations. And we would see, you know, we would correspond, the bacterial loads would correspond to the flood irrigation that's taking place. So the type of irrigation, you know, not only is the, and you mentioned that the cold water is being warmed, which pretty well eliminates it for being used by the fish. And it's coming back in from the fields loaded with temperature and with bacteria and with nutrients. And there's been, you know, efforts to control that through ponds that capture it. But there's some landowners, particularly in the upper watershed, that are really, I guess, invested in this style of irrigation. It's effective in terms of growing. It's not at all efficient, and it creates all kinds of problems for people and animals downstream. But they've been doing it for a long time, and the idea of changing it is something that they're not really interested in. Furthermore, there's not much incentive for conserving water because they're all operating with water rights. If you have a water right given to you, it's like, well, I mean, why should I use less? It's like, I mean, there's no, in fact, some people feel that if they don't use their water right, then someone's going to come along and say, well, you don't need that. So there's actually incentive to use more or to use everything that's given to you.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. This is a problem throughout the West, and it sounds like a really acute problem for the Shasta. So, Dave, something that you said earlier really spoke to me, which is that you've tried the kid glove approaches previously, and those have not worked. Can you talk through the history of trying to fix the river through more cooperative approaches and why those have failed?
Well, we started off, there was an organization called the Klamath River Basin Fishery Task Force, which was funded by Congress back in the mid-80s with the intention of rebuilding and restoring the salmon and steelhead runs in the Klamath Trinity Basin. And it was a 20-year program, and it was embarked on optimistically, and everyone hoped it would work, and it would you know, bring back the salmon numbers, which had plummeted on the coast and were you know, putting coastal communities out of business. Fishermen were losing their boats. They were going broke or having to move to Alaska or wherever. So it was a hard time for anybody reliant on salmon, whether they be tribal members as part of their culture, as part of their subsistence, or commercial fishermen, or sport fishermen, or the community that was supported off sport fishermen. All of them were suffering greatly as a result of crashing salmon numbers. And so the Klamath Task Force was looking for how it could effectively restore things in every tributary up and down the Klamath River primarily. And so they began funding outreach efforts and restoration efforts in the Shasta, the Scott, the Salmon River, the Happy Camp area, the smaller tributaries up and down the Klamath. And each of those watersheds sort of developed their homegrown grassroots restoration efforts. And in the Shasta Valley and Scott Valley also, was basically a consortium primarily of the water users, the ranchers, who recognized that if they could find a way to restore the productivity of the river for fish, then they wouldn't be faced with likely problems in the future if they failed, which is kind of where we're at now. And so I worked with them. We had what was called a coordinated resources management planning group, which went for many years. And I worked with individual landowners, one-on-one on the ground, livestock exclusion fencing to protect the stream banks, to cut down on the amount of just plain dirt that got into the river from hoof impacts, to reduce the grazing impacts that were taking away what little shade was left, tree planting along the banks, trying to increase the shade to keep the water temperatures cool, tailwater capture, trying to reduce the amount of hot water returning to the river, all the sorts of things that you wish would have just been part of normal doing business back as people at first moved to the area, but they don't pay. And so they don't happen. And everybody's just doing the best they can with what they've got to make a living. And so over the course of the 25 years I did that, I worked with myself, with this crimp group, later with the Shasta Valley Resources Conservation District, and several co-workers. And between us all, we brought in roughly $25 million for restoration efforts. And we certainly protected a lot of stream bank from hoof impacts, but no real substantial change in water volume, no substantial protection of cold water, and no real giant improvements in fish numbers. And those fish numbers are really the measure that we ought to be looking at. Not how hard we tried, but how much we succeeded. And so that's kind of what pushed the three of us and our sort of co-members of Friends of the Shasta River say, okay, we've kind of run that approach to ground. It's been kind of like sitting on a street corner with a tin cup looking for donations. You'll get a little bit, but you're not going to get a lot. And we've reached the point where between drought and climate change and increasing water usage, particularly groundwater usage, we can no longer afford to wait forever with the tin cup approach. So we're now going to up the ante and go for a more aggressive approach, utilizing existing laws and trying to push for protection of these public trust resources that belong to all of us and are critical to the cultural and economic survival of people downstream of us.
The Eco News Report. Join us, our Friends of the Shasta River. So there's a new threat to the Shasta River that Friends of the Shasta has been working to address, which is the rise or the implementation of safe harbor agreements on the Shasta. A safe harbor agreement is an end around on the Endangered Species Act. So the Endangered Species Act prohibits individuals from engaging in actions that will result in the taking of an endangered species. So if you're a rancher and you're taking too much water and you're dewatering that stream and you're causing salmon to die, or you're harming salmon such that you're impairing their ability to successfully reproduce or feed, that is an action that is prohibited under the law. It seems that in the Shasta, historically, the government has, instead of enforcing the law against these big ranchers, and we can talk about some of these big ranchers, it has instead given them money to try to do other things, right? To pay for stream bed restoration, as Dave said. And I think these safe harbor agreements follow in that kind of same path. But in addition to priming people for more government handouts and more welfare ranching, we are also giving them protections against groups like Friends of the Shasta ever coming after bad actors in the first place. So Andy, I want to bring you in here to talk about these safe harbor agreements and the threat that Friends of the Shasta sees in these documents, in these permits from the feds and from the state.
Well, so I guess I could preface this, the safe harbor agreement, by when I came into this, I knew very little about the Shasta River or the efforts to restore it. And so I went on a journey. My background in the law was all criminal law, to learn about water law in the Shasta River. And I read, I don't know, maybe five different coho recovery plans. And yet the coho haven't recovered. And so then I met with Dave and Bill, and they told me about this Safe Harbor Agreement. And I'd heard a little bit about it because being from the area, I was familiar with some folks that work for different larger environmental organizations who there was murmuring about this agreement, or the great work that was being done. And there's a piece of property that the state had bought, Big Springs Ranch, and all these little baby fish that were there. And, you know, I thought, wow, this is a great thing. Then I read these studies about these collaborative efforts to restore the fish that hadn't worked. And basically, Bill and Dave filled me in that Safe Harbor looked to be just another one of those collaborative agreements without any teeth. The remained to be seen what was going to be in the agreement. So within the last year, we've seen the agreement. We've seen the site plans, which are basically individual ranches and what they're willing to sacrifice in exchange for take permits. Basically, if they do things that attract endangered species to their property, they do conservation measures, fencing, maybe flow dedications, maybe opening up a spring that's been impounded, then they get a take permit in exchange so that if these actions draw the fish in and then there's some incidental take, they don't get prosecuted. Well, the first thing that I kind of observed was that there's not enough fish there right now to take. And then you look at the individual site plans, and some of them have little tidbits here and there, but none of them are really a big sacrifice. Come to appreciate that the perspective of essentially the government is that these are voluntary people that are going to participate in this great plan. And so we're going to just take what we can get and hope for the best. It looks no different to me than any of the other collaborative efforts that we've seen. Unfortunately, it's led me to the conclusion that absent some level of negotiating power, collaboration is not going to work because the other side is not going to give up what it takes. I drove by the Shasta just 2 days ago and saw a bunch of cows standing in Parks Creek, which is a key tributary. So I think we all at Friends of the Shasta River, based on what we've seen in Safe Harbor, don't see anything different than the other collaborative efforts that have let the stream get to the point where it's a travesty that in the state of California, such a wonderful piece of water could be so degraded that it's time to share the water, is our perspective.
So this is a bit of a David and Goliath story, right? So Friends of the Shasta, you all have wonderful energy in trying to save your river. You have great resource expertise. You all are terribly smart and good advocates for your place, but you're Dave, Andy, and Bill. You're not particularly large or powerful. Let's talk about the interests you are going up against, because I understand that there are some billionaires involved and there are some big players in Siskiyou County and in the California water system that are involved here. So who stands to benefit from these Safe Harbor agreements?
Well, I mean, I can go on that. You know, I guess this is where we're kind of coming out of the closet, but one of the prime pieces of ranch land is owned by Emerson Investments LLC, which is Red Emerson, which is Sierra Pacific Industries, and that contains key springs. They're impounded. They're run into ditches and then through multiple pastures. So by the time perfect fish water gets to the Shasta River, it is basically sewage. And that's one of the main problems. The other problem is that, you know, there's a consortium of water users, multiple ranches that are responsible for the Dwinnell Dam, which impounds on an average year all the snow melt so that there's virtually no hydrograph on the river. And so maybe they're not individually particularly wealthy and powerful as a group, they are very formidable. And then there's a number of other big, there's an outfit called Bel Campo that owns a huge ranch. They're fairly new to the valley, but they're super sophisticated. They sell their beef, a hamburger at one of their retail outlets in the big city costs $25. However, they are advertise themselves as sustainable. There's a picture of the earth on their Instagram feed, and yet you can't really discern what it is they do for the earth other than grow cows to sell at high prices, they and other livestock products. But so there's some really powerful, I think Belcampo is owned by a guy that worked in Wall Street and designed software, multi-billionaire. And so that the little guys, we definitely have a heart for. We have a heart for the ranching communities, but someone like Red Emerson doesn't need to degrade a river for a couple more nickels added to his billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar net worth.
Absolutely. And some of these interests are trying to get the government to help them pay for the improvements that they have listed in these safe harbor agreements. So I want to talk about something that's going to come up before the Wildlife Conservation Board, which is a multi-million dollar grant to more efficiently take water out of the Shasta River. So Dave, what is going on at the Wildlife Conservation Board, and what should the public say to the government here?
Well, a number of years ago, the people of California passed what was called Proposition 1, which was a giant bond act intended to do lots and lots and lots of infrastructure improvement projects, in-stream flow improvement projects, basically begin to address in a big way a lot of our water problems. And a big chunk of that money got allocated to the Wildlife Conservation Board to be spent on projects that proposed to do things that would increase in-stream flows. And so when the Safe Harbor Agreement came down, basically the participants there don't want to spend any of their own money on anything. So the commitment from NOAA Fisheries, who packaged these things up, was that they would grease the skids to make sure that public money paid for everything. And one of those everythings is to buy a pipeline for the Grenada Irrigation District. So the Grenada Irrigation District was formed in 1916. It's the last significant water user to come online in the Shasta Valley. Until it came online, there was plenty of water to go around for everyone. And once they came online, water was short every year and forced us into a court adjudication to try to sort out who gets water when. And the water user has been paying for a water master ever since. And the river has suffered as a consequence of demand so far exceeding supply that it never has enough for any kind of public trust resources. So the Grenada Irrigation District itself, as the most junior user, oftentimes, in fact, in all years, doesn't get all the water they wish they could get. And because of their physical location, somewhat far from the river, it costs them a lot to pump the water from the river up to their district. And so they get spotty supply of expensive water in a district where the soil isn't that great. And so it winds up to where their water tends to cost the water user more than the crop will justify. And the district itself is based on property taxes. And so if you're within the district, you either have to pay a standby fee, which shows up on your property tax bill, or you have to pay a standby fee plus a water delivery fee, which shows up on your property tax bill. And if you don't pay one or the other of those two, after 7 years, the county takes your property away and sells it at a tax auction. So you've got all these trapped people within a district with water that they can't make a living with anyway, and they are bleeding the river white for supporting a bad idea in the first place. So what they want to do is everything they can to lower the cost of delivered water and increase the number of people that are paying the cost of delivered water so they can spread their costs amongst more water users within the district. And so to have us buy them a pipeline will do several things. It will eliminate all the ditch leakage, which right now amounts to sometimes 25%, sometimes more of what they pump. So a quarter of what they pump out of the river goes back into the ground, and it may show up in the river eventually, but it's not well managed to get there. It just sinks back into the ground and is to a certain degree lost, which costs them a lot of money to pump. Their ditch is 5 miles long, which means if they need water today, they need to have turned their pumps on 2 days ago to get it. And sometimes it's hard to look ahead 2 days and know exactly what you want. And when they turn their pumps off, they've got 2 days worth of water sitting in their ditch, which they've paid to pump, which slowly trickles out because they're done. They actually irrigate on a cycle basis. They'll irrigate for 10 days or 2 weeks, and then they'll turn off, and they'll come back on again for 10 days or 2 weeks to turn off. So every time they turn off, all the water they pumped into their ditch basically is wasted money. So this pipeline would eliminate all of that because the pipeline wouldn't leak. When they turn it on at the river end, the water is instantly going to come out at the irrigation district end. So it would be a nice thing for the district. It will get them quicker, cheaper water. And if they get quicker, cheaper water, instead of only irrigating a third of the irrigation district, they'll be able to irrigate more of the irrigation district because the water will be cheaper. So more people will use the water and more people will grow crops, and they might almost break even, or maybe they'll even make a little money. But all in all, the net effect is going to be to make more water available for out-of-stream use. And what they're giving back is they're promising they will pump no more than 24 cubic feet per second. And they're claiming that in the past, they would routinely pump 40 cubic feet per second or 30 cubic feet per second. But when you look at the numbers they've reported to the state in their annual water use reports, they almost never are that high, either because the water is not available or because they can't use it because not enough people want the water because it costs too much. And so the benefits of pumping less water are paper water they never pumped. And the benefits to them are they'll have this pipeline that will make it cheaper to pump more water. It will increase their demand by lowering the delivered cost of water. And maybe the worst thing is that we're right now, as the available water in the river diminishes and their 40 cubic foot per second water right, the water available shrinks from 40 to 30 to 20 to 10 to 5 because there's just not enough water left in the river. They have to quit pumping because so much leaks out of the ditch, they don't get a usable amount at the far end. It just costs them a lot of money to pump 5 cubic feet per second into their ditch, so they quit. If they had a pipeline, they wouldn't lose all that leakage. So they can continue pumping down to much lower levels economically than they currently do. So we're going to take a river that's already bled white for water at low flow periods, and we're going to bleed it whiter, and we're going to call that improved water flow. And that's the problem.
That is a problem. And if you are angered by this, as I have been, you can find an action alert on the show notes for this episode, which you can find on the lostcoastoutpost.com. So click there and you can take action and email the Wildlife Conservation Board and request that they do not approve this grant to the Grenada Irrigation District. If you want to catch up on what's going on with the Friends of the Shasta River, Dave, where should folks go to find out more information?
Well, the best place to go right now is our website, ShastaRiver.org, all one word, ShastaRiver.org. And I have to tell you, building a website with people that have never built a website before is not an easy process, and I don't recommend it. So we are still under development. It's a struggle. We have no funding, if you will, so it's all volunteer work. But that's the place to come. Drop us an email. We'll keep you in the loop. We'll keep you informed. We can certainly email to anybody that's interested. And we will be building our information outreach day by day as we go.
All right. Well, thank you to Dave, Andy, and Bill from Friends of the Shasta for joining the Eco News Report. And thank you, listener, for joining us too. You can listen to the show every week on this time and channel. Tune back in, and I'll see you then. Bye.